Hello and welcome to a prelude to an episode of Is This Just Fantasy? So, we are supposed to be reading, rating, and reviewing Priory of the Orange Tree. That is not happening this week. Maybe never. Duncan and I have both been in the process of reading it over the course of taking some holiday, and so far neither of us has finished it. It's been about a month, and we just can't do it. I'm about halfway through, Duncan is about a third of the way through, if I'm generous, and we really don't think we're going to be able to finish this one. It would be the first time that neither of us has managed to start and finish a book on the podcast, and it would be disappointing if that was to take place, so I'm going to try and muscle through, but yeah, this is a pretty big fail on our part. To not give too great a summary of it, because, you know, we want to save that for review if it comes to exist, but it's quite boring. We don't like it. That's sad, because apparently it's really good. It's very well rated. I don't know why we dislike it so much. However, in the meantime, we're going to have two episodes for you. First things first, you'll be having this current episode, which is one we've been thinking about doing for a while, and which Duncan is very excited about, and I am too. That is a history of Conan the Barbarian and how it got sort of taken over by artists after Robert E. Howard's death. It's genuinely really funny and fascinating in places. And our next recording is going to be on The Last Unicorn by Peter S. Beagle, and that is also one that Duncan and I have been really excited about doing for a long time. So, without further ado, this episode's a cracker. I hope you enjoy. So long. Hello and welcome to another episode of Is This Just Fantasy, the podcast where every week two nerds normally get together to rate, read, and review a fantasy novel. I'm your host, Geordie Bailey.
And I'm his good friend and Conan the Barbarian super fan, Duncan Nicol.
And as I implied in the intro, Duncan, this is a special bonus episode. We are not reading, rating, or reviewing a fantasy novel. I mean, I guess you probably have in the past 2 weeks. I haven't had to do anything to prepare for this one, and I'm really chuffed about that.
That's absolutely right, Geordie. Listeners, this is a special episode. We got a question. We love it when we hear from you on either Instagram, It's a Fantasy Podcast, or on our Gmail, itsafantasypodcast@gmail.com. And we got a question that just hit my special interest. I just read this and I went, I have so much I want to say. God damn it, I'm doing a whole bonus episode on it because this is my like special subject. So as a mastermind, this is what I pick.
And for folks listening in countries that are not the United Kingdom, Mastermind is a TV show where people, instead of being asked like general knowledge on something like Jeopardy, they have to start off by, they get to pick the subject they get quizzed on, which means you get like really advanced, specific questions. And then, just in case you think you're too good at that, they do make you do general knowledge after that, and that's the worst round. It's so much less interesting.
It's really heartbreaking when someone actually isn't good at their special interest.
I know!
Well. It's just like, why? You could have picked anything, and you clearly don't know a lot about
it. I saw a guy once who picked Tintin as his like special interest, and I was like nailing it question after question. I was like, how do you not know this?
The highest score I ever saw on that show actually was for Stephen King's Dark Tower. Like, this woman was amazing at it. Like, fully answered before the question was done, just racking up the points.
So. And she got a whole 9 points because it's really hard to score well at Mastermind.
So, Geordie, as we start every episode, before we get into the main content, have you read any other books you want to talk about or seen anything fantasy related?
No, I haven't. Have you?
No.
Okay, on with the episode.
Perfect. But what was the question for today, people? It's probably somehow abbreviating the title of the episode, but to hear it again from our excellent listener, Kielhauser, I hope that's how you pronounce it, we had this question. I have an arbitrary request. I'm fond of Conan, minus the racism, good for you, mate. And I've read much of the Howard Conan material, but I'm curious about the additional material. I wonder if Duncan might be able to make a few suggestions where one might begin to explore the rest.
And now this is something I know, Duncan, you're interested in, because I, much like our dear pal, Kielhauser, I'm also a fan of Howard's Conan the Barbarian, but I haven't actually read much of the supplementary material either. You know, I've read all but one of the original stories. I've never actually finished Hour of the Dragon. I've read, like, some comic book adaptations, some of the Marvel, some of the Titan, a lot of the Dark Horse. But that's kind of where it ends for me, and I do consider myself a pretty advanced Conan fan.
And see, Jordy, you're already a fan. I'm sure a lot of our listeners haven't read Conan yet.
Sure.
And I think a lot of fantasy readers, particularly in the present day, haven't gone back and read Conan the Barbarian by Robert E. Howard. Despite maybe the influences had on the genre, yep, it's probably not the most actually well-read piece.
No, I mean, for sure, it wasn't well-read in its time, and it isn't well-read now, but it is so influential. So much of the stuff, you know, the DNA of modern fantasy has its origin in Conan. And so, Duncan, what I think you're putting down is, well, before we answer the actual question about supplemental material, we should sort of make a case for reading Conan itself, right?
Absolutely. Why should you care about me going on about the extra works written about Conan if you have no interest in reading the original? And you should always start at the original. I would lay that down happily. So yes, why should you read Conan by Robert E. Howard? Because as it alludes to in that original question, it has some problems. It was written in the 1930s. It is dated. There are some very unpleasant aspects there, but there are some real nuggets in there as well. So Geordie, one fan to another, why should someone read Conan the Barbarian?
So first things first, they're just well written, man. Like, even they really hold up. Aside from, like, as we have to keep saying, aside from the racism and, like, the sexism and stuff, and it's really bad. Like, if you go back and listen to our episode on Red Nails, we are shocked by how racist it is as fans of that story. Like, we like it, and we're like, holy shit, this is so much worse than I remember. It's just so exciting. The sword fights, the adventure, it's so fast-paced, and there's so much excitement and grit to it. I go back and I read the story Black Colossus all the time because I just love the final battle and how dramatic it is. It's so cinematic.
And I think there's so much to be, so much kind of kudos to be given to, one, this sort of era of short stories. So many people, big fans, you know, big series, Game of Thrones, Wheel of Time, Dark Tower, like, big thick books, big thick epic fantasy. This is heroic fantasy.
Prior of the Orange Tree.
That's an example. It's really nice to read somewhere an author's like, no, 8 pages, I'm going to deliver.
Yeah.
No time wasting here. And also another reason why I recommend to people, one of the reasons I actually got into it to begin with, is the fact that, talking about big influences on fantasy, who's probably the biggest influence on modern fantasy, Geordie, of the last 100 years?
J.R.R. Tolkien.
Absolutely. His shadow is everywhere, either because people are following him or people feel like they're consciously trying to be contrary to him. He has built the mold for which so many fantasy races are drawn from these days. And if you're ever thinking, gosh, I really want to get out of this shadow, I want to see something that doesn't have this influence, then you've got to go back before him. I almost think it's impossible to read something written after him and not see that influence. And that's what Conan the Barbarian does, what reading Robert E. Howard does. You're like, this is pre-Tolkien. The rules aren't set. One, a big factor in Conan is that it's meant to be a pre-history world. It's a fantasy setting, but oh no, it's pre-history, because the idea was just doing another world, secondary world fantasy, was not really a thing.
And the funny thing is that one of the people who carries on an influence that might have had, Lord of the Rings. Lord of the Rings, as fantastical as it is, that's also prehistory. That's set in our ancient past. But now we're getting bogged down. Yes, the Conan stories are great. You should read Tower of the Elephant. You should read Black Colossus. And then after you read those two, the world is your oyster. Go out, read it, get the complete Chronicle of Conan. It's the big black book. It's a really good value for money. We've made our case there, I think. This is uncharted territory for me. Like, I've heard you talk about pastiche material many times before, but I still really don't know much about how I should read it, or if I should, and what is worth reading.
That's quite the question. So I'm going to break this down. I'm going to break this down for people. And I do think, even if you haven't read the Conan stories, this is a fun journey through like different publishers, different rights ownerships. If you just have any kind of curious interest in how like franchises can be built and extended and moved and added to, this is going to be quite fun, I think. At least I think. I fucking love it. My partner once said to me that I enjoy more learning about how these books came to be than sometimes I enjoy reading them.
What I'm sort of expecting now is sort of like the story of all the various people who wrote for Spider-Man and took it over and how they changed it and augmented the character over time. Am I sort of being fair there?
Yeah, really true. This is the story of so many different authors coming, adding their piece. I think, you know, we're going to get up to, I think there's something like 12 to 14 different authors we're going to be touching on over this. And it's still being added to through different mediums and different creative minds. But before we kind of take that step, let's just go back a little bit. Okay, you're that individual, you're Killhauser, and you're like, Duncan, what do I read now? I've read all the works. And first thing I'd actually say is, maybe go out and read some more Robert E. Howard. Robert E. Howard was a very prolific author. He wrote many a heroic hero. And if you enjoy Conan, go and read King Cole.
Yeah, we read Cole like this year, I think. And it's a blast. I'd never read any Cole before, aside from a comic book adaptation. And I had an amazing time.
It really is. Go and listen to that episode. We talk about him. Some people call him the proto-Conan. We kind of make the argument, well, maybe he's actually the purer version and that Conan was the watered-down, mass-marketed version. Not only did Robert E. Howard write King Cole, he also wrote other fantasy heroes, including Solomon Kane, his sort of 17th century Puritan, who goes on all sorts of more sort of traditionally gothic adventures, but also dips into that Cthulhu element. So let's start on this journey, Geordie. 1930s. Tragic early death of Robert E. Howard. And
yeah,
all his works at the time had been written and released in pulp. Weird tales, adventure tales, pulp fiction in the truest form. Cheap to print, disposable.
Not meant to be saved. Like, meant to be thrown away and forgotten. It's not meant to be put into a book in the future.
Completely. And they don't see print for maybe 15 to 20 years. Completely off into obscurity. And then a gentleman comes along, and I'm so sorry for ruining his name. I'm going to try and pronounce his first name, and then I may just call him by his last name for the rest of this episode. L. Sprague de Camp.
Sprague, like Prague.
Thank you, Geordie.
No, thank you, Geordie. Very incorrect, Geordie. So, I could not have possibly imagined this. It's not Sprague, nor is it Sprague, it's Sprague. I really wish I'd looked it up in advance of the episode or paused to check then, but who could have thought it was Sprague? That's... anyway. I'm also just, like, not clear. It could be Camp, but I'm pretty sure it's Camp.
El Sprague de Camp.
De Camp.
Maybe Camp.
I will be calling it Camp because that's how it's been in my head, but Geordie probably has the right way of it. This gentleman comes along and he speaks to the Howard Estate and he's like, can I republish these? Can I repackage them and publish them?
Future Geordie back again. Boy, there sure are a lot of corrections in this episode when we're trying to be informative and correct. Duncan has asked me to correctly attribute the person who inherited the Howard Estate because it wasn't actually Sprague de Camp. It was Glenn Lord who got the rights. He just let de Camp use them. So yes, that is another correction. I hope there won't be any more.
And he goes to Gnome Press, and over the course of the 1950s, we get all of Robert E. Howard's Conan stories once again put out in bound hardbacks.
Are they a major hit? Do they take the literary world by storm?
The highest print number for one of these hardbacks was 3,000.
I mean, that's not terrible, given the time period, given the lack of press. It's not like the modern day where you sell a million copies. So, yeah, that's probably
not a major disaster, but it's
not
a hit. A revolution. It's certainly the idea of...
That's probably more than the original run of Lord of the Rings sold in America. I think that might be true.
That is shocking to actually discover that is true. But it was still very much... compiled by a fan for the fans. This, remember, this is like 15, 20 years later. This is for like the young men who grew up with these Pulp Fiction stories, now wanting a hardcover to like store, read again in their older age. That's certainly how I see it. But lo and behold, oh, also fun fact, one of the known books was called Conan the Barbarian, one of the collections. And this is actually the first time that the name Conan the Barbarian was applied to the character.
Uh-huh.
Robert E. Howe never did it. It was for this collection. And these stories were also put in chronological order, or at least DeCamp's chronological order, for the first time. But something then happened.
Right.
So these come out. There's like five of them to collect all the stories. But then a fan, Geordie. A fan from, and I'm really sorry, he's from, I believe it was the Netherlands. This guy, Bjorn Nyberg.
He was actually Swedish. His name was Nyberg, but the pronunciation in English is Nyberg.
He likes Conan. He likes him a lot. So he writes a fanfic.
As one does, and he put it up on archive.org.
He wrote a fanfic called The Return of Conan, and he even has a self-insert character in it. Like, how cringy is that? Never would have done that myself. But he writes it, and he sends it to DeCamp, who currently owns, obviously, is the looking after the rights to Conan. And DeCamp goes, yeah, that's pretty good. Shall we publish it? And that was it. That was the first ever officially licensed. And if I was somewhere, first ever, obviously, a fan writer could have written something anywhere and kept it in their attic. Conan the Barbarian story,
sure,
not written by Robert E. Howard.
Right. So this is really interesting. And obviously, I'm sure people who are listening to this now, you know, this is a podcast about fantasy literature, probably big literature fans, and would be aware that this is pretty weird. That doesn't happen that often. You know, fan works, for one thing, are in a legally grey area, and when I say legally grey area, they are pretty much all illegal, but everyone knows you kind of just be a dick if you stomped on them, so we don't. It's like jaywalking in America. It is illegal, not enforced.
I know, it's so odd. When people talk about writing for franchise now, it's like, yeah, you just have to be an established author and they will, like, invite you. This guy just sent his book in and went, what do you think? And the rights holders just went, cool. It's official. Well done.
Is it any good?
The Return of Conan? It's genuinely not one of the worst. I actually think it's okay. He clearly has a love for the character, and it often reads, I would say, more like a direct sequel to The Hour of the Dragon, which, by the way, was retitled the known press to Conan the Conqueror, and it keeps that title for, like, the next 70 years. Well, 50 at least.
Really? That's very strange.
Very strange. But it gets things moving.
Then again, I don't remember there being any dragons in that story.
The Hour of the Dragon refers to the fact that the neighbouring country's flag is a dragon. So the Hour of the Dragon is referring to the time that their flag flew above Conan's country.
Okay, fair enough. So it'd be like if we named a story The Hour of the Fleur-de-Lis.
Exactly. Ish. The Reign of the Lions. I mean, there is actually Three Hearts, Three Lions.
Yes, well, we'll get into that sometime. That's probably connected to Conan.
Oh, yes, it is. We'll get to that later.
Well, we can't get distracted anymore. Okay, Return of Conan, and then I'm assuming that's going to open the floodgates. Other fans are going to say, oh my god, I've been writing fan fiction on archive.org for years. Now I can make money off of it? Hell yeah.
Not quite. It's still a little bit as the trickle started, and DeCamp then sees that this sells well. And so he goes back and he looks at the Conan stories. But what more, he goes back and looks at the non-Conan stories written by Robert E. Howard. And he thinks, wow, these aren't going to sell because they're not Conan. I can change that. And so DeCamp puts out a collection called The Tales of Conan, where he took five separate stories of other Robert E. characters from across time periods.
Sure.
Some were like Crusader heroes, some were like set in Afghanistan, like the 1800s. And he rewrote them to be Conan stories in the Hyborian Age.
Oh, wait, hang on, what?
Yep.
That sounds super immoral.
What, rewriting another author's work and publishing it?
Yeah, going back and taking a dead, quite forgotten author who died tragically, taking their work and like repackaging it to make it more palatable to a mainstream audience. That's disgusting.
Hold on to that thought, Geordie, because I have a really complicated relationship with De Camp and what he did to Robert E. Howe's work. Because on one hand, he did that, and he did that a lot. On the other hand,
okay,
there is a strong argument that maybe the world wouldn't remember Conan the Barbarian without him.
Sure, I hear what you're saying. I'm a fan of Star Trek, and I have a complicated relationship with both Gene Roddenberry and Rick Berman, because like, Gene Roddenberry, much like Robert E. Howard, is the damaged genius who created a classic story, which is still going today, but has a lot of gross, you know, outdated elements, and had a problematic life in of himself. And then you have someone else who comes in the future. So Rick Berman comes along, he picks up Gene Roddenberry's legacy, and he keeps it alive, but he also is a jerk. Like a huge jerk, and in some ways bastardizes what remains. And then he makes a Phantom Menace too, which is just a real kick in the teeth.
Ooh. Yikes. I was about to say De Camp does nothing that bad, but I'm not quite sure of those words. But let's continue with our story, Geordie. We're in the 1950s. These are selling, you know, 3,000. That's the biggest seller. Some are as low as 1.5. I think there might be one which didn't break the 1,000 mark. This is still very niche. But in 1966, Lancer comes along, publishing house. They like the look. There's an idea. You don't need big hardbacks. They're difficult. They're expensive. We're going to go paperback. We're going to get a little known artist on board called Frank Frazetta.
Yes, now we're talking. Frank Frazetta.
Frank Frazetta defined the look of Conan. Before Frank Frazetta came along, if you looked at an image of Conan, he looked like some sort of centurion in half the images. Very almost 1920s idea of what just a leading actor would look like.
Folks, if you don't recognize the name Frank Frazetta, you do recognize the look. He's one of the most iconic, popular artists of the 20th century. He has this real great reverence for, like, muscular physiques and, like, skimpy clad damsels in distress. You could equally see him, like, drawing a half-naked barbarian and, like, an astronaut with a ray gun. If you can try and find the middle ground between those images, yes, you're imagining Frank Frazetta.
To be quite honest, if you take one thing away from this episode and you're like, I'm still not interested in reading Conan, just go and Google Frank Frazetta and spend some time looking at his artwork, because I bet you
that's a good way to spend half an hour.
You will see his influence, or you will see one thing and be like, I've seen that before. But he comes in, they start doing paperbacks. Another Sword and Sorcery author, a guy called Lynn Carter, he gets brought into the fold with De Camp and Nyberg. Nyberg doesn't go away. He continues to work with them and writes other short stories. And they produce the Lancer series. Now, the Lancer series covers, I believe, 12 books. Geordie, if the Known Press series 3000 was good, do you want to know the numbers for like Lancer? Just order of magnitude?
Sure. What is it?
It's multiple millions. It's... Whoa! In 1969, the Conan Lancer series was second only to Lord of the Rings in terms of fantasy series sales.
Really? That's crazy.
It was an insane spike.
Duncan, you introduced me to the world of Conan the Barbarian 8 years ago in 2016. I had no idea that even nearly close to 1 million copies of Conan had ever been sold.
It's incredible. I think you look at the numbers, and obviously this is a while ago. Back in the 1960s, but you're like, how did this hit such a range and then sort of slave off? You think about it, though, Conan got a movie adaptation before Lord of the Rings was off the ground. Like, this was a known property, this sold.
Yes, and recognizable names are always key to what gets made in Hollywood. I want to just check in though, Duncan. We're talking about the Lancer series. Are these reprintings of Robert E. Howard, or are we talking about fan fictions? Pastiche stories.
So we're talking about both. So in this era, we get re-releases of all Robert E. Howard's works again. Once again, put into a De Camp-approved chronological order. And also, the Tales of Conan stories are a little bit sneakily just fitted in now with the Robert E. Howard ones. A lot of these books go by the title of like Conan the Adventurer by Robert E. Howard, and then it'll just go edited by DeCamp.
Yes, yes. You told me about this in the Cole episode about how like some of the Cole stories, it will just say like, what was he exactly said? Like,
yeah, it's so, like I said, they always, their names would be there, be like edited by, but edited by sometimes means fully rewriting ends of stories. Taking stories and writing and the new endings. It's insane.
Right. Like you said in the Cole episode that like DeCamp wrote like a new backstory for Cole and then did like a huge paragraph in the opening page, like making up this old story that Robert E. Howard didn't come up with, right?
In that particular case, it was Lynn Carter, but yes, exactly that. They used to do, between the short stories, they'd write like little paragraphs that'd be like, this is what Conan did between this time and this time, to sort of build this sort of continuous narrative. You know, this is the year where Thoth Amon became like the main villain of Conan.
Sure.
Now, a few new stories were written at this time. We had one book by Lynn Carter called Conan of the Isle, where this is the oldest Conan we ever see. This is Conan when he finally leaves the throne, where he ends up at the end of the Robert E. Howard stories and goes off on new adventures.
Old man Conan.
Yep. Sailing the seas, heading out for the Americas of the Hyborian Age. We also get a really cool pirating story in Conan the Buccaneer. We also get Conan of Aquilonia, which I actually really like. This is a series of short stories with Conan and his son, Con. And son for four stories.
Okay, so I'm getting a picture here. This is where they're just writing new stories. Lynn Carter and DeCamp and this other guy, this Dutch guy, they're writing them up. So how long does that go on for then? And also, is any of it worth reading?
So this goes from like 66 all the way through to 77. Bear in mind, in this time period, this is when the comic books start. In 1970, like coming off 96, where it's like the second highest fantasy series of all time, Marvel, guy called Roy Thompson, is like, we need to get in on that. But yes, back to what ones are worth reading. Great question.
Roy Thompson is already working on this.
Yeah.
Okay, I'm going to jump in here and I say, so I know the name Roy Thompson because I'm pretty sure he's still working on Conan today, right?
Yep, Roy Thomas. He was an editor at Marvel in the 1970s. He wrote, I believe, more, in terms of actual page count, he probably has written more Conan Piss-J's work than any other man alive, but he did it all in comics. And to this day, bear in mind, it's been like 54 years since he first wrote Conan. He is still often brought in by the comic book publishers as like a guest writer. It's very prestigious. When Roy Thomas steps in, you're like, okay, now the king's back. Let's see how he's going to do it.
So this is really fascinating because we've gotten on like 40 years from the death of Robert E. Howard. And now it seems like it's changed hands twice. You've got a DeCamp era, and that's a long period of time. 40 years to be writing another author's work. I was moaning about, I was moaning in our Dune episode about Brian Herbert taking over from Frank. This is so much worse.
Oh, DeCamp goes right up to the 82 film. DeCamp writes the novelization of the Arnold Schwarzenegger movie script. Like, he is there
50 years.
Yeah, 30 years. He really gets involved in the 50s, where the known press is like being collected, and then he stays heavily involved up till the early 1980s.
Okay, fair enough.
But he was the rights owner. He was managing the IP. When Roy Thomas want to make Conan comics, he had to go to DeCamp and be like, hi, we can offer you this much an issue. Apparently Roy Thomas... Sorry, we're getting off track. What stories?
Yes.
Books you want to hear?
Yes, so... we've got an era here from in the 1950s up to the 1970s. This is where Lynn Carter and Sprague DeCamp and some guy in Holland are writing pastiche stories. We haven't gone to the comic books yet. Is there anything good for fans of Conan to check out in that period?
Not massively. And I'm going to say that sounds really mean of me, but I genuinely feel like this isn't the golden age. I, no offence to De Camp and Encarta, but I just don't think they were quite the hottest authors. I think Return of Conan is very interesting to read from the, it's the start, it's the spark that like sets the fire. I also really do enjoy the Conan of the Isles book, just because it goes so left field in weird and bizarre. It kind of has its own fun, campy charm. I once tried to explain it to someone when I'm like, when I'm reading this book, I'm not seeing the monsters. I'm seeing cheesy effects, Sinbad, gold, you know, the Seventh Voyage of Sinbad effects of these monsters in my head, because it's just got that weird vibe. But I don't think this is the golden age for Conan. Just not quite yet. Not in Lancer, not in 1977. We've just got to go a little bit further, Geordie, just to the next era before we actually get works that I think people should start reading. So
what is the next era? Is it a comic book?
No, we're going to stay with the novel, the prose works, and then we'll come back to comics at the end. I think that's just the only way to do it. So,
fair enough.
Lancer finishes, and we move on to Baton books, 78 to 82. What happens here? So, De Camp and Carter, they've done their era. They're running out of juice, Geordie. They need more fuel in the tank. They need to get fresh blood in. So, in this era, also Ace Moroto also had the rights for a little bit. It's quite confusing. I don't fully understand it. But nonetheless, there are new people writing. And this is where they bring in Andrew Offutt, Carl Wagner, and good old Paul Anderson of...
Oh, Paul Anderson. There we go. There's our Three Hearts, Three Lions.
Absolutely. And these guys come in and they write some excellent stories. Carl Wagner writes Conan and the Road of Kings. Andrew Offutt writes a whole trilogy. Only the first one do I recommend. Conan and the Sorcerer. Paul Anderson writes Conan the Rebel, which is the first time I think someone attempts to expand on the era between the chapters in Queen of the Black Coast, where Conan has this kind of piracy adventure off page. And finally, De Camp gets what I think to be his, like, hurrah. De Camp, Linkata, and Nieberg write Conan the Swordsman, which is one of the very few... Weirdly, Geordie, weirdly, so very few times do people write original short story Conan fiction. This is like the only collection out there where people just...
Okay, so up till now, it's all been novels, these like extra stories they're writing.
So there was the Tales of Conan that we mentioned earlier. Conan of Aquilonia is technically like marketed as four short stories, but they're four short stories that follow each other chronologically, like back to back. It feels like a novel. I don't care what people claim. So yeah, this is the first time short stories were back in. And it's called Conan the Swordsman. And I really enjoy this. Mostly because, guess what, Geordie? Conan works really well in a short story format.
Really? That's so weird. You'd think it would be... Yeah.
And very few people seem to understand this or willing to go for this. Maybe it doesn't sell. Maybe it's just not what the market wanted. That's basically the same thing. But... It's one of the few instances where they just put out a short story collection. And what I really enjoyed about this short story collection is the fact that they actually do like little sequels or like additions to a lot of the Robert E. Howard stories. You know, if you enjoy Paul of the Black Ones, then we've got Gem in the Tower, which is him with the pirate crew just before that adventure. If you enjoyed Maneaters of Zamboa, because, I don't know, you have issues, then you'll really enjoy Star of Korra.
You have just mentioned the two worst Conan stories back to back.
But, like, the Star of Korra, I'm really sorry, I'm butchering that fantasy pronunciation, written by Nieberg, one of my absolute favourites. We get, like, there's a story where Conan's got this magic jewel and he wants to ransom it back to this princess who had it stolen from originally. But oh no, the princess had been captured and put in a tower. What's Conan going to do? Well, now he's got to save the damsel in distress so that he can then take her back to her ancestral home in Aquilonia and ransom her there and make money that way. And then so we get like a heist as he breaks into the tower to rescue the princess. We get a chase scene as he runs to the border. And we get this like legend style last stand where he can't make it, but he spots some ruins on the horizon. And he rides there, puts the princess in a little enclave and goes, wait here. And he goes up and he takes his stand on the ruined battlements. Brilliant.
And then asks Crom for help.
And if he doesn't answer, to hell with him. Like, these are really good stories.
So that one you like. So one more time for clarity. What are the stories from that you recommend?
I really recommend Andrew Offit's Conan the Sorcerer, Carl Ragner, Conan and the Road of Kings, and DeCamp, Lynn Carter, and Nieberg's joint effort, Conan the Swordsman. Really the jewel to their crown. Everything that they wrote really came together in that short story collection.
I think since we're in the right era, and I hate to distract you too much, is this an opportunity for you to talk about the Conan movie, or would you have spend too much time on that and take up the oxygen of the episode?
No, I can talk about that. This is 82. So this era, when the publishing leaves Bateson Books, that's when the film comes out in 82. And we get to the next era. So yeah, this is exactly when the time to speak. So what do you want to know about the film? Arnold Schwarzenegger.
I only saw it like this year, last year, for the first time. I thought it's enjoyable. Yeah.
I have a really controversial opinion considering my love of the character, but I actually am just like, it's okay.
Yeah. It's not really a Conan movie, but it's a pretty good sword and sorcery desert movie.
Yeah, I agree. I think Arnold Schwarzenegger is really fun. To be honest, I would recommend it to more fans of Arnold Schwarzenegger than I would fans of Conan the Barbarian. I think sure. I'd say that very easily. And quite controversially, I think I enjoyed reading the novelization of the film by DeCamp than I enjoyed watching it. Because he then takes the time to then work the film into the lore like a lot more. I appreciated that.
Mm.
Yeah, the film was hugely successful. The character reached new heights. By the way, the film was very much like the combination of like the millions of books being sold and the very successful comic book that had been running for a decade at this point. Not just a comic book, mm-hmm. sorry, three simultaneous comic books were coming out by
yes,
this point.
Yes, you'll get into that later, I suppose, but that is going to be an interesting thing.
Right. Deep breath, Geordie. Little aside. Just so you know, if I made any mistakes, please forgive me, because I live in the UK. And in the UK, all of Lancer, all of Batem, and a bit of Tor, which we'll get to now, weren't actually released by those publishers. If I look at my shelf, it will just say Sphere. Sphere Books collected all these series and published them in the UK in their own weird number ordering system. So my bookshelf is no help to me when doing this. I am specifically talking about a lot of American publishers because they were what were driving it.
Duncan, I find it very interesting that you used the word bookshelf, because I have been in your office when we were at university together, and I think what you really meant is bookshelves, plural.
Yes, that would be correct. To store
yeah, I don't think your partner would have forgiven me if I had let that one slide.
It was a hard time at uni. I had a very small bookshelf, and I did fill up the entire thing with Conan books, and once my partner kindly reorganized my bookshelf to help fit them all better, but instead of having the books, you know, like a sane person, like spine running vertically, put them all into the spines were horizontal so I could
no!
fit more in.
No!
And Geordie, she did this for when I like came home from work and then was like, look, I did this for you, let's go have dinner. I had to put my like fork down halfway through dinner and go, I'm really sorry, but I can't eat knowing they're like that upstairs. I might have some slight issues.
Okay. Well, that's a classic Duncan story right there. That should really be the intro to all our episodes, because then people would just be like, oh yeah, I know what this podcast's about.
So, Geordie, let's get on to the biggest jump in our timeline. We're going to go from 82 to 2004.
Okie dokie.
And in that period, we're going to talk about, probably not individually, the 43 Conan the Barbarian novels put out by Tor Books.
Okay, so before you break down 43 separate novels, which is about equivalent to 2 years of us doing this podcast and breaking down various novels, how much time are you going to commit to each one of these?
I am not going to go through every novel, don't you worry. What I'm going to do is I'm going to break this down by author, because there's a number of authors that kind of took turns during this era, I believe 8 in total. So I'm just going to do a little bit for each of them to give an idea of the times and like what was driving this. Because this is an insane endeavour. This is like 2 books a year. Solid.
Or roughly equivalent to 1 Brandon Sanderson.
Absolutely. I recently found out a little bit more about the Wandering Inn series, or the Wandering Tavern, and the insane length of that, and I suddenly thought, right, everything's now in perspective. You're all not long, don't worry. I'm sorry, Brandon Sanderson, you were being concise. How could I misjudge you? So.
Okay. So, eight authors.
Starting off in 82, the movie's out, it's hot, Tor just got the license, and they need fantasy, they need it now, the world wants Conan. Who are you going to call?
Who?
Robert Jordan, obviously, of Wheel of Time
fame. Yes, Robert Jordan, of course.
Robert Jordan.
To write Conan the Avenger, right?
Actually, Conan the Avenger is a retitling of The Return of Conan by Nieberg, but let's not go into that.
Motherfucker. Okay, fine. I did my best. Conan the Soldier? The Mercenary? What is it?
Conan the Mercenary was the second in the trilogy by Andrew Offutt.
Oh, for God's sakes. What did he write?
He wrote Conan the Invincible, Conan the Defender, Conan the Unconquered, Conan the Magnificent, Conan the Victorious, Conan the Destroyer novelization, and Conan the Triumphant. How could you get that wrong, Geordie? And you know what? That's not even in my notes. That was off the top of my head.
Okay, thanks for flexing on me like Arnold Schwarzenegger. I looked so smug as I was like, it was Conan the Avenger? I'm on Mastermind right now, and this is my special topic. Okay, what a fail on my part.
7 books, Geordie. How many years to write 7 books?
Well, Robert Jordan wrote some really big books, so clearly he could write things pretty quick. 7 books, I'm going to say 5 years.
You insult him, 2.
2? Oh boy, wow.
He cranked these out, and this is very much why he was picked for the job. He wrote a book, I believe it's called Daughters of Attila, and he didn't get picked because of the strength of that book. He got picked because he wrote it quickly. And I would say,
sure, Isaac Asimov.
If you want to know something about like why I think he managed to do it so quickly, is that, yeah, he wrote 7 books. He maybe wrote 2 plots. And then
okay, because he was very repetitive?
Oh, incredibly so. He had a good formula, to be fair. And this is a formula which a lot of the following authors would kind of adhere to a certain extent. He was very much about, let's make Conan, keep him quite young, keep him in his early days, as much as you can. Make sure that the villain is a POV character, so we can literally just see what his evil plot's going to be. And all the characterization is through his eyes. And also, let's try and make Conan a bit more heroic. I think this is definitely his Conan is a bit more Superman. He's got that S on his chest. He's a little bit more like, I will just go and be the hero. Don't you worry.
Wait, hang on. Duncan, are you telling me that Robert Jordan starts to get a little bit repetitive? Was Conan tugging on his braid a lot?
No, yeah, but all the authors know those volcanic blue eyes. They're the first thing you always describe.
So he's heroic now.
He's a bit more
heroic. He's not really like a...
Yeah, that's his
anti-hero character.
And I don't mind it. It's fine. He's got the Hyborian age. He has respect. And he's a good writer. That's a controversial thing to say. Robert Jordan is a solid writer. He can handle this.
I can't find out in time.
Weird of time. All right. Next 4 blokes I'm going to talk about all at once. Because these are the guys. So Robert Jordan then steps away. 84. He's off the books. What we then get is 4 authors step up to the plate. And these guys work together, sort of like how the Call of Duty games are made by like 3 different studios. So they keep them yearly, but like they all get time off. Except these 4 authors, it was 2 books a year. And you get 1 year between them. So the pace kind of cools a bit. And these
So now we're talking like early Star Wars stuff. We've got people saying Mara Jade is here, Mara Jade isn't here, Mara Jade's hooking up with Lando, oh no, she isn't, she's with Luke.
Very much so, because quite a few of these authors would come up with their own like bespoke side characters, except unlike in Star Wars where everyone's like just using other people's like characters and doing them in different ways, these guys are just like, they're so this is how I imagine it, they're just so focused and so like, I've just got to get this out. They ain't reading the other guy's work. They have no idea. So one will write in a side character, and then the next bloke will just pretend they don't exist, write in their own side character, and then because the timeline's so wibbly-wobbly, you'll read them in chronological order and go, right, this guy's with Conan. He then just disappears for a book. And then the next book, he's just standing next to him again. It's just like, oh, yeah, I was here the whole time. Ignore me.
How many, like, Red Sonja Baylet clones are we getting in this era?
A lot. The strong sort of warrior woman character runs through a lot of these. Robert Jordan had one that he used three times called, I think it was like Krilla the Red Hawk. Very popular. Carl Wagner did a really good one where Conan has to go to like this barbarian themed masquerade ball. That sounds so stupid saying out loud. I actually really like that
it
story.
It does. It sounds, I got embarrassed when you said that.
Yeah. But there's a character in there which literally is a Red Sonja insert. A woman comes up to Conan in this ridiculous chainmail bikini and then Conan scoffs at it because how silly.
Come on. Okay, okay.
And we get, so let's actually talk about these authors. John Roberts. He wrote an excellent historical fiction series called the SPQR. You can guess what that's about. And he was a great author. He wrote 8 Conan books, and he's one of my personal favourites. I'd actually say of this era, anything by John Roberts, John Maddox Roberts, because he maybe isn't the strongest author who ever touched Conan, but I do genuinely feel that he got the character. When he's writing like Conan the Valorous or Conan the Champion, you're like, yes, he's here. This is Robert E. Howard's Conan. What this guy does do, though, which is a bit odd. So John Roberts, never mind, we talked earlier about like short stories.
Sure, yeah.
This guy gets it. John Roberts said in an interview once, I'd write my Conan story, I'd hand it to my publisher, and they'd just be like, oh, this is fantastic. It's only 120 pages. And he'd be like, yeah. And they're like, we need more. And he's like, but I'm done. That's the story. And they're like, yeah, you need more. And he actually, if you read his stories, you can really vibe this. In Conan the Valorous, there's just a section where you get about 2/3 through. And then Conan just goes on a side mission. And it's a good side mission. And you're almost like, well, this could just almost be its own short story. But it's so crowbarred in. And then as soon as it's resolved, Conan's like, nope, don't mention it again. There's a moment in Conan the Champion, which this is going to sound really bad. John Roberts is really good. There's a bit in that where Conan literally goes to a fey world. Like, he's defending a village, a sorcerer pops up, creates a portal, a monster drags the Lady of the Day back through the portal, Conan dies after her, and we get like 60 pages of the Feywild and evil elves in like dark obelisk castles. And
oh dear, this is not very Conan.
I know, it's horrific, and we go for it. But what's so kind of amusing is that the moment Conan gets back through the portal and it snaps shut, it's not mentioned again for like the next 60 pages.
Yeah, of course not.
Just didn't happen. God. Moving on.
Okay, well, that's embarrassing. It's the January one, that sounds like the pacing of Bioshock Infinite. And two, I didn't realize that Conan this period of time was being published by Shonen Jump, because that's for shit they do, and being like, no, don't you dare end this series. You gotta keep pumping this shit out. What are the side characters up to, Taisei Kubo? Come on, we gotta have maybe 100 more chapters of this battle.
It is painful. You can tell these guys put for their paces. So let's just rattle through the rest of them. I don't want to be here for like ever. Lennon Carpenter. I really don't actually want to talk about these guys, because like, when else am I ever going to shine a spotlight on what I think these people did? Lennon Carpenter.
No, hurry up.
Middleman. Like, C grade. Wrote really good ones. Conan the Renegade and Conan the Raider. Wrote really bad ones like Conan the Warlord and I can't even remember some of the others, but sort of very middle. When he's good, when he's fighting Conan the Raider, and it's like this mummy's tomb, Egypt setting,
nice,
and he's
good.
Like breaking in, and he's in the dark tomb, and he can hear this slow shuffling of feet, and you realise it's like one of the mummies are wandering about. Amazing. But he can also just be really boring. Conan the Savage is Conan becomes Bear Grylls, and Leonard Carpenter goes really hardcore on like Conan surviving. He like falls down a river and he has to like, you know, make a fire and then create a little shelter, and he goes really super detailed, and I'm like, okay, I'm sure someone out there, this is their thing, but this is just dull, mate. Sorry, not for a Conan story.
Chris Ryan writes Conan, whatever, moving on.
Steve Perry. We all know Steve Perry, Shadow of the Empire. He wrote for Forgotten Realms.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, he's a name. Do you want to know my favourite Conan story quote by Steve Perry?
Is this the one about the demon being obviously male?
Even a blind man could see how obviously male the demon was.
That was very necessary for the story, Steve. Good job.
Steve Perry is one that's once, originally, I hate her. I thought, you don't care for the character. You don't give a shit. You just keep going, like, thews and thighs and sinews and strength, and you don't get it. You don't get it. And then I just realise, who cares? It's hilarious. This guy is off the charts. This is every, like, parody, but just it's official. In fact, it's better than parody, to be quite honest.
Wait a second. I just realised something. The fact that, like, actual people were writing fanfiction and then sending it to Lynn Carter, that means that...
Oh, the Eye of Argon?
Yeah, the Eye of Argon. That could have been official Conan.
To quote Carl Wagner, who wrote Conan the Road of Kings, to be quite honest, everything that we write for Conan is just fanfiction. And is as much legitimate to the canon of Robert E. Howard as something you write yourself. Well, I'm paraphrasing slightly, but that was his sentiment.
If you don't mind, Duncan, after the episode, try and find the exact quote, because I feel like that'd be nice to add to the episode.
I will look for it.
Duncan has to unfortunately admit that he searched everywhere, from interviews to fan sites and the very book itself, but he could not find the actual quote which this was attributed to, so he apologises.
And then we have Roland Green. He wrote 7 Conan novels. I have very little to say about him. I think he's just a bit dull, but not atrocious. But in some respect, being boring is probably worse than being Steve Perry levels of fucking insane.
Sure, because that's the one thing the Conan stories aren't. The reason why we recommended them in the first place and said they're worth reading, they're exciting, they're quick.
Quick is the word. So talk about speed. So we said, like, average 2 books a year. Yeah, that's average. 89, 4 novels, 1 year. 2 by the same
Jesus
bloke.
Jesus Christ. This literally, you're starting to sound like, you're starting to sound like Hamilton at this point.
1970, yeah. Anyway, I'm not going to wrap this. I should write a book on that.
Okay. Hang on. Roland Green wrote the other... 4. Okay, maybe it's not that impressive this time, but, you know, you get my point.
Yeah, Leonard Carpenter, 11 books. Roland Green, 7 books. Like, they are coming fast. But then things do begin to calm down a little bit. We get some new blood in there. Sean A. Moore wrote 3 books. Apparently they're good. I haven't been able to track them down, sadly. He also wrote the Cold Conqueror novelization. Again, haven't been able to track it down. Then we get 2 names, which I think are quite interesting. Harry Turtledove writes the last Conan novel published by Tor.
Turtledove, okay. Famed writer of alternative histories, which are sometimes quite bad.
I've heard he's written quite a lot of what if the American Civil War went the other way.
He writes alternate history stuff, so I'm most familiar with him based on, like, the shit stuff he wrote, because I follow some, like, guys who do, like, alternate history stuff on YouTube, and I've seen this thing, a summarization of a book series he did, where it's like, what if, like, of the Americas were like a collection of smaller islands, and then he just writes American history again, and, like, makes no changes, just changes the names of, like, individual characters, and it makes it so much less interesting. He sounds like a bad writer, just from my understanding of his work.
I'm going to tell you now, he wrote Canon of Venerium, and it's not regarded as a very good book. He had very little care for Sumerian culture, something that John Roberts definitely loved a lot. He wrote an excellent Sumeria. But there's one other name who came just at the tail end of Tor, and this name I think is actually the most important from this era. Despite my love for John Roberts, despite how good Robert Jordan is an author, this guy I think is truly important, and that's John C. Hocking.
Okay, I have never heard his name before.
Really? Because, Geordie, if you look to your bookshelf, you'll have a book by him on it.
Are you trying to tell me about the Dark Horse collections? Because I have those on Comixology.
I'm telling you about the book that was published this year.
Ah.
Conan and the City of the Dead was written by John C. Hocking, was Conan and the Emerald Lotus, the, like, second-to-last Tor book that came out, I think, in, like, the early 2000s.
Are they good?
They are quite possibly the single greatest grasping of the character of Conan outside Robert E. Howard.
Wow. Okay. That's crazy that that's the guy whose name I didn't recognize. I recognize Harry Turtledove, but not this guy.
John Singh Hocking has written, as far as I'm aware, 2 novels and 1 short story. There's 2 Conan novels and it's 1 Conan short story.
Wow. Okay. Generally, so this guy is legitimately a fanfic writer. He's not like a published author.
Absolutely. Apparently, he sent in... So I'm sorry, I am trying to... A little bit from hearsay, so I do apologies, John, if I do get the story right, incorrect. John, like, wanted to get published by Tor because he felt that they were getting off character. He was unhappy with where it was going. So he did an Eberg. He wrote his own Conan story and he was like, submitted it. He's like, please, can this go out? And they went, damn, that's good. Absolutely.
This is every fucking Star Wars fan's dream, to be able to write to Disney or George Lucas and be like, you need to fix the story. I'm the genius who's going to make it happen. And then for them to go, wow, you're actually, this guy is better at Star Wars than us. Let us all bow down and give him $1 million.
And just to say, John Singh Hocking, he seems to be a really great guy. He's really active on the Reddit pages. He's even responded to a few of my posts. He seems like a really nice man.
Well, that's nice.
So he wrote Conan the Emerald Lotus, the one name I want you to remember from the Tor era. That is the okay. Conan book to read.
I've already he then wrote... What was it again? Conan Citadel of the Emerald Lotus.
Conan and the Emerald Lotus.
Ah, that's close.
He then wrote a sequel, Conan and the... I believe it's called The Living Plague.
Alrighty.
And he wrote it. It was finished. And... before it was published, Tor were like, oh, we're handing over the rights. Sorry. Boo. And it went back in a drawer.
Wait, is that the City of the Dead? Is that he's had it in a drawer for like...
For 20 years? Yes.
For 20 years?
In fact, in like, I remember reading like 2017, I believe it was on the Blackgate website, they literally put up a review. They went, yeah, we contacted John. He sent us the manuscript. Here's our review for it.
That's
and I'm like,
such
thank
a
you
dick
for reviewing
move.
A book
can't
I can't
write a
read.
For a book you can't read.
So when I found out it was actually going to get published, I was thrilled. And we
it's
will
so
get to that later, I'm sure. So, Tor has ended. And to be honest, this is the twilight years. Conan's about to enter a lull. We had amazing 60s, 70s, 80s. But the 90s... oversaturated on books. Quality was
okay,
dropping.
Hang on. Before we jump in there, Duncan, I think I'm going to have to ask you to crack down again. Give me the rapid rundown of the good stuff from this era.
The absolute best is Conan the Emerald Lotus by John Singh Hocking. It's available in a collection with The City of the Dead if you buy the hardback today. My 2 favourite authors from this era is John Roberts. I think he got the character of Conan perfectly. And Robert Jordan, he's just a really good writer. Robert Jordan, you can read his work in the collection Conan Chronicles. John Roberts, some of it's available on Kindle, some of it's harder to hunt down. He is worth it, though.
And you'd say those are the guys to watch out for. You don't really have to mess around with the others you mentioned.
I really don't think so. I've read some of their books, and I like their books. Leonard Carpenter, I like Conan the Renegade and Conan the Raider. But listen, that's like the next level. You've got get through the really good stuff first. Get through the A and B tier, and then I'll tell you about the decent C tier stuff.
Okay, so earlier you mentioned we're in the 2000s, but now you've mentioned the 90s. What time period are we going into now?
Okay, so Tor was from the 82 to 04.
Right.
So... in the 90s, things were kind of building down. We'd had the big splurge of the films. Marvel, in the early 2000s, sold the rights, or didn't renew the license. So Dark Horse took on the license. This is very much a new era.
Hooray!
And in this era, the first things we get are actually, for the first time, Geordie, Robert E. Howard's Conan is collected and released as he wrote it. This is
Hallelujah. Really
important. Gerlant's put out their big black hardcover of the Complete Chronicles of Conan, and Del
it's
Rey
beautiful.
Put out their 3 paperbacks.
It's a wonderful book. I remember having a wonderful holiday in Greece, reading it on the beach. To this day, if I run my finger along the spine of that book, there are small pebbles embedded in between the spine and the book from that beach.
It is a beautiful collection. The Del Rey versions are equally nice if you want to go down that route. And Geordie, this is really important because during the whole of this, ever since, like, even the known press stuff, that was edited by DeCamp. This is wow. Robert East Howard's actual words finally coming through good and pure. And that is really important.
Hi, I'm putting my hand up. Professor Nickel.
Yes?
Is that because DeCamp is dead?
Yes.
That's so, back down. You had to wait for this guy to die before Robert E. Howard's, like, actual work could be experienced by the general public.
I will just say, it could be a coincidence. But one looking at it from the outside.
I think I might just take that "but" and, like, amplify it, like, 10 times.
It's like the Star Wars Legends getting put into Legends. It's like, it could be coincidence, it just so happened to be at the Disney buyout. But.
Okay.
So we finally get this wonderful era. A new dawn. Dark Horse has started their legendary run at this time on the comic book side. But before we go over to comics, we've got to hit a few more quick books.
I'm listening. I think we should hit this quite quickly.
Cool. They made an MMO. Massive Multiplayer Online game, and they cracked out
the famous penis slider one.
Absolutely. They had 12 novels come out, literally all within, like, the same year to time with the release of the MMO. They had 4 trilogies commissioned by different authors. And across the board, I generally say these weren't very good, but they are interesting because for the first time, they wanted to tell stories that were set in Hyboria, but not starring Conan.
Here's the weirdest thing, Duncan. Of all the things that I cannot remember, like where I left my keys and what is my mother's birthday, I have a vivid memory of you describing this series to me for the first time and, like, talking about how, like, this one book is about, like, the tribe which Conan comes from after he's left, and about how, like, this one hero has to leave, but once you leave Sumeria, you can never come back, and you complaining that that's not true because Conan's granddad came back.
Yes, I have that complaint. It bothered me the entirety of the Legend of Kern series. They're like, when you're out of the tribe, you're out of the tribe. I'm like, well, that doesn't work, because then how could have Conan's grandfather gone on the adventures to inspire his grandson and not come back to the tribe? Just doesn't make sense, does it?
And then you pushed your glasses up your nose and you snorted.
Exactly. And also, in this particular book, all the Sumerians wear ponchos, and that's hilarious.
Yes, I remember you told me about that, the ponchos.
They wear ponchos and kilts.
That's a classic, yeah, because not everyone wears ponchos and kilts. That's like, they go together like ham and cheese.
So, there's that. There's a one about Heretic and Stygia, like, which is kind of cool, but it's not very well written. There's another one about a Aquilonian soldier, which again, is kind of cool, not very well written. And another one which I can't find, about some marauders somewhere. Hey, moving on.
So 12 shit books, whatever.
Yeah, 2011, there's a film tie-in by Michael Stackpole. Michael Stackpole the X-Wing books for Star Wars. He's a pretty decent writer, and the book is better than the movie, but that's not a high bar.
All right, can you give a review of the movie in 45 seconds?
Jason Momoa is a good actor. It's a shame he was given nothing good to do. Ron Perlman is also a good actor. Again, a terrible shame he had nothing good to do. It's vaguely more related to the book series than the Arnold Schwarzenegger ones, but not really that related. They don't know how to pronounce Acheron, and it's actually just not very well filmed. And I watched it with my little sister once. I spent £1.50 in a used shop to get the DVD, and I felt like I wasted my £1.50. But it was fun to laugh at with my little sister a little bit, I'm not gonna lie.
Well, there we go.
Okay.
And the real problem with that movie, and it's a bitch, is that even today, you're like, who should play Conan?
Jason Momoa,
obviously. And I wasted their shot with it. Shake my damn head.
So, we then get a real dead period, which is really kind of ironic, because this is 2011 that comes out, and then we have 11 years The years in which I got into Conan with nothing.
Funny, yeah.
And then finally, to the current present day, 2022, Heroic Signatures through Titan start putting out new Conan stories. They kicked it off with S.M. Serling's Blood of the Serpent, which is written as a direct prequel to Red Nails. I've had it on my bookshelf for about a year and a half. I haven't actually read it yet. Oops, sorry. I'm sure it's good. I'll get around to it.
So is that like the story of Valeria then?
Yes. It's about Conan meeting Valeria. And to be honest, it's a bit kind of funny because you read this opening to Red Nails. It actually goes, Conan was happy to be on this adventure because he had been having a really boring time in a Stygian outpost. And it's like, well, that doesn't sound like a fun setup. But okay. And if you buy the hardcover, you get Red Nails in the back, which is kind of cool. I'm not going to lie. But what we also get is Conan the City of the Dead by John C. Hocking. It finally came out, Geordie. It took 20 years.
This is the only Conan story I have ever purchased before you.
I know. I can't wait to get it and read it. Probably talk about it with you. If you buy Conan the City of the Dead, the hardback edition, you will get both Emerald Lotus and the new story in that single hardback. This is the purchase.
What should I read first?
I know.
A conundrum we will grapple with in the future.
And finally, gosh, this is going to be a while to get to. We're here at present day, currently being put out by Heroic Signatures. Is there their Heroic series? I can't remember the exact name of the series, but they're putting out a series of Conan short fiction, short stories once again, are being released for Very Kindle nice. Only at the moment. I presume there might be a physical collection further down the line, but they're literally £1.50.
Allow me to amend that. Boo, unless we are now sponsored by Amazon, in which case, hooray.
This has been really cool to see. It's like the original spirit of Robert E. Howard again. Lots of different authors. We're getting one a month. They're literally like £1.50, £2 or $3 or your equivalent. And it's not just Conan. We've also got Solomon Kane's stories, Bran McMorn, and some Baydett stories focusing on the character from Queen of the Black Coast. And they're really cool. It's okay. A great time to be a Conan fan. Okay, we got to the end, Geordie. I did it.
Very nice. And now that was our episode, everyone. There's nothing else left to cover. Duncan, thank you so much for that informative ride.
Sadly, we're not done yet, Geordie. There's still one thing, I say one thing, quite a few things we've got to hit, and that's Conan in comic books. Because some of the best pastiche writing has actually been in the Conan comic books.
And he's well suited for comic books. Like, this is a character who, there's so much emphasis on action, that one story in particular, I would say, is actually better as a comic book than it is a story. The Jewels of Gwalior.
Yes, so the servant's a bit yakin, or whatever title you want to go for it. It's an Indiana Jones story. It's a Tomb Raider story.
It is. It is. And it's so much less confusing when you can just see what's happening instead of having Robert try to explain, okay, so this is happening in this room, and there's a shortcut over to this room, and just like, I can just draw these locations. There. Are you happy? And I'm like, oh my god, I finally understand what happened to that story.
So, okay, let's hit this. Let's go back in time. We're not in 2020 anymore. Back in 1970, Roy Thomas goes to Stan Lee and goes, Lee, we've got to get on this like fantasy stuff. It's going to be big. And Lee's like, man, are things superheroes? I don't know. And Roy's like, no.
We do superheroes and we do space cars. And
Roy's like, no, you've got to do this. And Lee's like, okay, but this is your budget. And Roy looks at it and goes, I'm going to have to sacrifice my own salary because that budget is so laughably small, I'm embarrassed to go to the rights holders with it.
Wow, how low was the budget? Like, could they even afford a colorist?
So they could have a colorist, but they couldn't. He couldn't have the original, his top pick for an artist. He wanted John Buscema. He got Barry Windsor Smith. Gold there. The man's a genius when it comes to comic book artwork. He did his own work called Monster.
Okay.
Beautiful. But literally, I think it was something as low as $150 per an issue to the rights holder, which, although it was more money in the 1970s, was still laughably little money.
Right, so it's sort of a point where, like, it's not even worth the money to put the reputation of a brand on the line to tell, like, extra Conan stories.
Pretty much. And it got to the point where Roy was actually going to go to Linkarta, who had his own barbarian hero called Thongor Lemeria, and see if he could negotiate that character instead. But he did his best. He sacrificed his own money. He didn't get John on it. He got Barry Windsor Smith, and he did get Conan. And it had a solid 5 issues before Stanley cancelled it.
Okay, so this is not one that I've ever heard of or read.
No, this is the original coloured Marvel Conan the Barbarian from the 1970s. It is a great comic book if you like Bronze Age comics, to be honest. It's not really for the Super Conan fan, I would say, first and foremost. This is for people who kind of like comic books of that era. I love the original Marvel Star Wars run. I think it has a lot more blood with that. That said, it does the best adaptation of Queen of the Black Coast. Better than Howard. It's amazing. Roy Thomas is a genius. But
that's very high praise for that one, Dan. So the reason why I made my joke, Duncan, about not being able to afford a colorist is I assumed what you were talking about is the black and white version of Conan. Is that the next one to come along?
Yes, 75, we get Savage Sword of Conan, a spin-off from Savage Tales. Anyway, Savage Sword of Conan was what Roy wanted to do because it was going to be in a magazine. And a magazine didn't have to adhere to the comic code of the times, which means you could have nudity and blood.
Blood, yes!
So what Roy did is that the coloured series would do like Conan's early years from, you know, Sumeria just up to Black Colossus, and then Savage Sword started at Black Colossus and kind of went forward, although it was a lot more episodic in nature.
Okay.
And both Black Colossus got adapted twice, at the very end of the coloured and at the very start of Savage Sword.
Okay, so we're talking about those 5 issues then. That's what we're talking about right now.
Oh, sorry. Yeah, I know. I'm getting confused now. You made me jump. Yeah, Stanley cancelled it for issue 5, and Roy literally got on his hands and knees and went, look, the last issue sold moderately better. Can we please have it back? And Stan relented, and it went on to run for 275 issues.
Stanley is kind of justifiably commemorated within the comic space. You know, he's an incredibly influential and important figure. But man, did he make some mistakes.
He didn't. I think Roy Thomas has said in interviews, like, Stan, great man. He didn't see what they were doing, because what they were doing was quite different. Roy wanted to do this barbarian, almost anti-hero, magical figure. And Stan Lee's like, mate, our bestseller is Fantastic Four. What is this? But time would tell. Roy Thomas was pretty much right on this. It was a huge seller for them. Roy wrote the first 115 issues of Conan the Barbarian, the coloured one, and the first 60 issues of the Black and White Savage Sword. And we return later to write the ends of them.
Okay.
Worth noting, adaptations. Roy Thomas, adapted every Conan story before the start of the Tor books. So all of that thing that I spoke about, every single, apart from Road of Kings, shame on you, that would have been amazing to see. But every other one, and Conan the Rebel. Okay, those two. Oh my God.
Okay,
I take
so
back what I said.
He's adapting these pastiche works into it as well.
Yeah, absolutely. He's following De Camp's. Remember, this is 1970. It's all one thing, mate. So he was adapting the pastiche works, things that De Camp had rewritten. He adapted Nyberg's books, Linkarta's original stories. And not only that, Roy, he did a De Camp. He did the same thing. He rewrote other Robert E. Howard's stories into Conan stories for the comic book.
I see. So you're talking about him doing, The Veil of Lost Women? Like, something like that?
No, I'm talking about him doing The Valley of the Lost People, or The Valley of Iskander, which was a historic fiction of Alexander the Great getting lost in a time warp, but rewriting it to be a Conan story. I'm talking about him buying the rights to other authors' work, like, I think it's called The Flame in the Wind, and another one which I think is called The Valley of the Bear Gods, and writing them as Conan stories.
I mean, it's better that he's, like, paying these people to do it, I guess, but still.
I don't know this, like, the whole history behind it. It was carrying on the tradition, because, like, Roy kind of said, Conan was what was selling. So if he wanted these stories to see publication, they had to star Conan. But he also gave us Red Sonja, so I really let him off.
Okay, so that, and what you're talking about there, is that both coloured and black and white?
That is in both coloured and black and white. In black and white, okay. He adapted so many of the Lynn Carter, De Camp, Nyberg era stuff.
Do you want to share, so, and for personal stuff, so the coloured one, the Marvel one you're talking about, is the one that you lent to me back in second year of university, right?
Yes.
Okay, so my brief bit of insight I can get into this, because I read, like, the first issue of one of those, and I got up to, like, what is it? Maybe not Shadazar. Is it Shadazar? No, not Shadazar.
Yeah. Shadazar, Shadow over Shadazar.
Yes, Shadow over Shadazar. There's a bat monster. And yeah. At that point, I was like, I just am not enjoying this because it's not bloody, and it feels kind of kids glovey, and it feels like a Fantastic Four story somewhat. It's not as gritty and dark as I hope for from a Conan story.
I cannot argue with you. The colour comic definitely has that vibe. I think, and that's why the black and white one, Roy knew this, and that's why he pushed for the black and white one to be created. So he
it
could
feels
do
a lot
both.
Like something like He-Man or The Legend of Zelda cartoon, like where swords don't actually cut things. Swords are all blunt or they shoot laser beams, so you don't have to show someone being slashed.
Definitely the case. If you read any of the interviews with Roy, so when Dark Horse collected this series, Roy actually took the liberty of going back and changing things that he got really annoyed with the censors for. And in all the backs of the Dark Horse collections, it's Roy's basically going, yeah, I had a fight with the censors over this. I had a fight with them over that. They wouldn't let me do this. So there's loads of instances. There's one where he wanted Conan to behead a guy, but they said, well, you can't. So what he did was he had the guy be really fat, and then he told the artist, in the panel, I want you to show his head, and then don't show like it's been beheaded, but the fact that we can't see his fat body in that one panel would imply we've cut it off.
What? Okay, I don't really get what you're putting down there, but whatever.
No, it was weird. There was also an instance where he wanted Baylet to be like the mating dance. He's like, and then Baylet will do the mating dance for Conan. And the censor was like, you can't do that. And he was like, what's the matter? And they're like, you need to write love dance. And he's like, oh, that means the same. And the censor's like, you know it's not.
That's so... Okay, that would be a fucking funny conversation to be on the fly in the wall for.
Anyway, so he did that. If you're interested in that, Savage Sword, the black and white stuff, was amazing. It is a bugger to find collected these days, but it has been collected multiple times. If you want the hardcore Conan, the coloured stuff, I love with a deep passion. But Geordie's right, it is a little bit more watered down in terms of like visceralness. But if you can just bite into it, it's like any... I think it has enough of that vibe of like a really good kids show. You know?
The Vanaheim section of it at the beginning, though, genuinely, I liked it. It's weird, it's out there, it doesn't feel like a faithful adaptation, but it's just like a good Saturday morning cartoon barbarian story.
So, moving on quickly. So, Marvel Comics has some good runs. There was a King Conan series for a bit. I really love that too. We get a lot of Conan and his children. That's a story for another day. I could do a whole episode on just that. But
right. And Marvel to eventually... hone in this again, because this was you said this in the section where it was a bit confusing, but the Marvel coloured run, I think you're saying, is the one where you say it's the best version of Queen of the Black Coast, right?
Absolutely. It's 42 issues long, and it gives the time to the characters to really see Conan and Baylet actually fall in love like nothing else. And in fact, the 4-part story arc, I know, issue 60 to 64 is, I absolutely adore it. Conan gets his name Amra in that story arc, and it's absolutely fantastic.
So, after Coloured Marvel and Savage Sword, the black and white one, what's next?
We get a short-lived King Conan comic, Coloured, by Marvel. And then, as we get into the 90s, Marvel, they're sputtering a bit. They're resetting to issue one a few times. They're trying to get the juices flowing. I can't say the juices flowing. Trying to get the engines revving again. But ultimately, it's a bit of a lost cause. Roy Thomas comes back, he does brilliantly, but by the start of the 2000s, Sword and Sorcery's kind of done. Marvel aren't interested. So
yeah, and Marvel at the time, I believe that's like the major downturn for Marvel. Like, that's when comic books were just not making money anymore.
That's when they were like, let's sell off our superhero rights because we're not making our own movies anytime soon. So they give up the rights, and Conan ultimately ends up with Dark Horse, with a launch in 2004 by the fantastic Kurt Busiek and Carrie Nord.
Nah, it's Busiek.
Geordi, I can finally give my voice a rest. Tell everyone why this series is fantastic while I sip some water.
So, thank you, Duncan, for letting me take over here. This is the first thing that Duncan ever introduced me to after I finished Conan, because I asked the exact same question. What should I do now? And Duncan said, there's a really good comic book. It follows Conan's, basically his entire career, from the very, very beginning with the rhyme about a frost maiden, the frost giant's daughter, all the way up to, and now we get a little confusing, but basically it begins with this absolutely gorgeously drawn section where you see the very first adventures of Conan, and then as it jumps from story to story, so Frost Giant's Daughter to Tower of the Elephant, they, much like other authors Duncan has mentioned before, they take those like little sample stories, like stories that Robert E. Howard maybe never finished, and they implant it in, and they tell other stories in the meantime to bridge the gap. So we're basically following the journey of Conan, like his winding road trip all through the kingdoms of Aquilonia and I forget the place's names. I'm sorry.
Zamora and Tehran.
Yes, thank you. I don't think he goes to Tehran in this series, actually. But there is also some cringe early 2000s shit.
Yes. I think that's fair to say.
Beautiful art. Occasionally, this one, like, hey, we're going to do our own version of Red Sonja, but she's edgy and dark. And wait, Geordi, don't throw it away. She's gone. Okay, we won't show her again for like 100 issues. Don't worry. But there are some just really great adaptations of stories. They do some great stuff in like giving continuity to the tales, really making it feel like Conan is actually experiencing these various adventures and he remembers that he's been on them, and friends from prior adventures will show up and like throwaway characters who are mentioned in a story. Oh my god, that was actually like a long-term ally of Conan, and it's now actually tragic in Rogues of the House, where Conan's ally is hanged for his crimes. He was like our friend for a long time.
Do you know what? And this is like, sorry, I'm actually going to go back and praise Marvel again, because this isn't exclusive to Dark Horse. Like, Marvel did this as well. Roy Thomas sets up things. Generally, there's one character who gets his setup like 180 issues before it gets payoff, because Roy Thomas was like, this character, it's referenced in Jewels of Galore that he'd met Conan before. Well, when did that happen? So something, he meets a guy in like issue 30 that we generally don't see again for nearly like 200 issues to do the same thing.
Now, speaking of Jewels of Galore, that's pretty well established in fan chronologies of Conan. That's like in the latter half of his career. How do we know that? Because it takes place in Vendia. Vendia's in the deep south, so it would take him a long time to get there. The Dark Horse run never makes it to Jewels of Gwalior.
No, not chronologically. So this is
it
a bit
upsetting.
It does
peter out.
Yes, so the Marvel run basically covers it between the Coloured and Savage Sword. Dark Horse doesn't. Dark Horse does a really solid run of about 150 issues. But we get to, I think it was Iron Shadows and Moonlight, Devil in Iron, which is a story of kind of, it was about the midway point.
I don't think we even got to Devil in Iron, did we?
It did indeed. Conan the Slayer adapts Devil in Iron. He sadly died. I do think it was running out of steam. For me, And this is why I actually still have that love for the Marvel. Even though it has that kid cartoon vibe, and when the fantastic Jim Owsley was writing, it felt very Saturday morning's cartoon. But like the best one. I really want to emphasise that. So what Marvel did so well was Baylette. 42 issues. A brilliant romance of a pirate queen and her barbarian lover. They sail up and down the coast. When Dark Horse decided to do this, things went a little wrong, in my opinion.
I'd like to hear this, Duncan, because for very specific reasons, despite loving your series, I haven't actually read this part, and I'll get into my reason why, but you go ahead first.
Okay, so the first sort of 80 issues, we get a great run by Carrie Nord. We then get a second run working with Timothy Truman, also an excellent writer, and Roy Thomas comes back for a few issues.
So then what stories are we covering there?
So we're talking about, in chronological terms, we're talking about Conan, everything that he does up until Queen of the Black Coast via the Darkstorm chronology. So Black Colossus, Iron Shadows of the Moonlight, all the thief stories, all have happened.
There's such good bits in Dark Horse. That's true.
They are perfect. But then Brian Wood, who I have some issues with, he wrote some Star Wars I didn't like, takes over for the pirating arc. I feel until like Berserk. He gets on the boat. And
you can't make that joke. You haven't got there yet.
It's not all... And this was really interesting because I felt, although we had different artists and different writers, Dark Horse felt like they had one continuity. Brian Wood felt like he just started afresh. Like he was issue one and no one had written anything before. Conan looks different. Conan acts different. The artwork is widely inconsistent.
This is where the art style gets really...
And I know that's subjective, but we both agree on it.
It gets very 2D and fuzzy and dirty. The very, very earliest of the Conan run went for quite a distinct photorealistic style, which is not necessarily, like, in any way necessarily better than more stylistic or exaggerated styles. I don't mean that in the slightest. That imagery, in fact, gets sort of toned down. It gets a bit more comic booky, like standard modern comic book styles.
It's something that you see in the early issues, and one of the great kind of stylistic choices that were made is that they didn't actually ink. They used to colour straight over pencil sketches, so you wouldn't have hard outlines.
Yes, that's right. It has a slightly ethereal feel to it. It's soft, and it feels round and warm.
That all goes out the window at this stage in the comic. Like, thick lines. And I know it's stylistic, but dear God, I hate it.
They have, like, black eyes. Like, the eyes aren't even drawn with, like, colour. It feels like something out of, like, Darkest Dungeon, almost.
And I think it really upsets the mood of the series, because up to this point, it felt like it was in continuity. And although I do feel like the next arc, Conan the Avenger, every time a new writing team comes in, they give him a new moniker at the end. They do get more back on track. This, I felt, really disrupted this series.
Conan the Avenger, is that like the witch trial section followed up, which then goes up to like Slivering Shadow or whatever?
Slightly different order, but yes, you get Slivering Shadow, you get A Witch Shall Be Born, and you get... Oh, what is it called? It's the Robert E. Howard story that he never finished. Like Tusks in the Dark? No, I can't, that's not it.
I don't know what you're talking about, sorry.
One sec.
Whilst Duncan's looking for stuff, I'm going to just lay out my issue with the Baylet section. And this has nothing to do with the comic book itself. It is completely down to a problem.
I don't know what I'm talking about either.
Okay, there we go. So, I read all of this, aside from the very first part, which Duncan generously gave to me as a comic book, I read all of this on Comixology using the Comixology app. Duncan, we will save your rants about the Comixology app for another episode, because you will go on for about the length of the episode so far, if I let
you. Rest in peace. We love you. You have now died.
There is a thing called Guided View, or there was a thing called Guided View. I think it's gone now, right?
It is not as it once was. Again, rest in peace.
Okay, so Guided View in Comixology meant that even though you're looking at it on your phone, which is not big enough to do a full comics page and be able to appreciate it, as you swipe across, like you're turning pages, it will focus in on individual panels, so you get a nice close-up view, and you can read everything, and then it will zoom out and it'll open up so you can see more of the page, and you basically go down like you're holding the page up really close to your face. And not only is that a way to make it accessible to people who are reading it on their phone, on the bus, it's actually sometimes legitimately a better way to experience comic books. Because someone like me, Duncan, my eye is prone to wander. I often ruin stuff myself on a comics page, because I open a page, I read everything at once, and I ruin the pacing of jokes, or like I ruin a surprise that's coming on the next page. But if I get guided view, I get to just read it piece by piece as the author intended, and that's great. Until we get to this section of comic book, where it just stops working. They would just open up with a full establishing shot of the full page so you can see everything, and then if it did zoom in, sometimes it was just like half the page is shown, or like it's literally out of frame. Like you would just see like half a text box being cut off. Sloppy, I bought it, I wasted my money, I skimmed through that section, Baylet died, and I was like, eh, whatever.
It's what killed it, and it's actually why, despite the fact that obviously from a modern reader's perspective, I would recommend Dark Horse over the original Marvel, there's still that little bit of me that goes, yeah, but in the original Marvel, when Baylet died, Duncan, did you shed a tear? And I have to be like, yeah, Roy got me. He got me good.
So, that is the only thing that you've ever explained to me about the Marvel run has made me actually interested in reading it. So I may pinch that from you at some point in the future.
So that is Dark Horse. We can gush about it. It's a little hard to come by now, but Marvel did collect in Epic Collection format, and Dark Horse did their own omnibuses and volumes. It is worth seeking out if you are a fan. Then we did move over. The rights went back to Marvel for a little bit. They didn't adapt any of the... they didn't do adaptations of any of the Robert E. Howard stuff again. They got Conan quite marvelised. They did Savage Avengers. They brought into the modern day. It was a very weird 4 years. I think it was 2019 to like 2003. Was it even that long?
2023, you mean?
Yes.
I don't know. I only read some of those stories. They were okay. I never read any of the modern stuff because I was like, I have better things to do with my time.
Yeah, they did a real good, like, throw everything at the wall. They tried to do this thing where they called Age of Conan, where they'd have other characters like Valeria and Baylet to be the leads of the comics. And I love this concept. I think Hyborian Age is a cool setting that can be explored through other characters. It's just yet to be done well. Anywhere.
Unless it's being dungeon mastered by you.
Absolutely. Thank you, Geordie. That is the right answer. You'll get another session one day. So, then, pushing on, because I don't want to waste time, end of the Marvel run, when it returned, after it went Marvel, Dark Horse, Marvel, a great writer called Jim Zub came along, and he wrote the last sort of 12 issues of that Marvel run, and they are very good. The last sort of 8... fantastic. He really hit his stride, and then he was cut down. The rights were taken away from them again. Marvel, I don't think they didn't renew the rights, is the correct term phrase. And you're like, oh no, but Jim Zub, he had such good ideas. What's going to happen? Well, the new rights holders at Titan, they went, hey Jim, you got a load of Conan stories planned? And he went, yes. And they're like, cool, you want to write for us? And he went, yes. And here we
all
are
right,
today.
So let me just quickly file off some names. All right, we're good to go. These are, wink, wink, totally original stories that I was not trying to sell to Marvel.
I'm sure that wasn't the case. But you know what? If it was, grand tradition. Let's rename some things. Let's make some edits.
Yes, but this is stuff that he came up with.
And granted, it's still using Conan, but that's a whole kettle of fish.
And the new run is a great way to start and get onto it. It's original stories. Some of the artwork really invokes a blend of that classic Marvel stuff by John Buscema and a more modern approach. They've also done Savage Sword of Conan, the black and white magazine from like 75. It's back. I have like 3 issues. They're doing a black and white magazine again, Geordie, and it's amazing.
Really? I did not know that.
It is incredible. They're doing some collections. They're 3 issues per collection, but they're releasing black and white magazines. So you get a black and white Conan story. You get a poem with an illustrated picture. You get a short story. And then at the back of the issue, you get a section of a Solomon Kane story. At least that's how the first 3 issues have been paced. And they've been incredible.
Well, so basically they said, what's our business model going to be? Well, I think we should specifically pitch this series at Duncan Nichol. I think he'll like it. And if anyone else buys it, that's okay.
Very much the case. I literally went into a comic book shop and I was like, do you have the new issue? And he's the guy was like, yeah, we have all of them. No one's buying them. I'm like, I will take every issue you have. Not multiples, obviously. I was just like, yeah, if you've got issue 1, 2, 3, I'll just take the lot. Come on, find them. The guy was so keen because he went through his shop and was like, I know I have issue 3. I can't. No, you said you would buy it. I will find it for you. And he literally made me give him his my number. And he was like, how long are you in town? I'm like, I don't know, for the next sort of 3 hours. He's like, I will ring you if I find it.
Wow.
So
that's a guy who's dedicated to his craft.
He needed respect. To shift some stock.
I will say this. So you just reminded me of my comic book story regarding Conan, which is nothing like yours. Because when I was living in America, I had an amazing comic shop near me. And I went there all the time. And I was reading stuff I'd never read before. I wasn't picking up any series that I was like actually invested in. Like even like manga I'd been reading, I was dropping. But what I got really into was I just started picking up indie comic books. And what started to happen is the guys who run the store are such cool guys. Sometimes when you buy books, they have paid attention to what you are reading and they just throw in a free first issue of a comic book. And they're like, you want to read more of this, right? And I'm like, hell yeah. And that's how I ended up reading a lot of like feminist sports comic books. I can't remember the names of many of them because I don't think we're that successful, but I had a really great time. And so one day, when a new Conan comic book came out, I'm like, ooh, I take it. I put it down on the counter. The guy looks down and says, Conan, from you. And he was so shocked and appalled because it was so unlike everything else I'd ever purchased from him.
That's that classic masculine, toxic masculine representation coming through.
Exactly. It's like, well, I thought this guy was pretty woke, but I guess not. Jeez. Anyway,
let's move to a wrap up because we have rambled on about our love for long enough. So, to answer to your question, Kielhauser, what do I read after the Robert E. Howard stuff? Well, firstly, glad you read it. If you haven't read it and you're listening, read it. If you want to know what happens next and you've heard that whole long story of publication history and comics and books and you're just like, I don't know. Guys, this is too much. I'm in the car. I can't remember anything you said. Duncan keeps throwing out Conan the and random words. What do I buy? This is what you buy, people. You go to your local Waterstones or whatever your main brand bookshop is these days. Maybe Amazon.
They're not selling any of these at Waterstones.
Quite possibly. Most certainly right. You go and buy Conan and the City of the Dead by John C. Hocking. You get two great Conan stories in one. It's fantastic.
Probably better off going to Forbidden Planet if you're in the UK.
Then, if you want to dig a little deeper, I highly recommend you go and read Conan, The Road of Kings by Carl Wagner. It's a little harder to come by, but you should be able to find it quite cheaply in youth bookstores across the countries. You go and read Conan the Swordsman to get a good idea of short story collections by De Camp and Lynn Carter and just that era, get flavour for that era. You go and read Conan and the Sorcerer by Andrew Offit. You do not read anything else by him. They're very much bad in comparison to the first one. And finally, you go and read any Conan, and this is a bit of a cheat, by Robert Jordan or John Roberts. Both of them did an excellent job. Robert Jordan is much easier to come by because it's available on Kindle. Very rare for any Conan FSJ to be there. And you give that a shot. And then finally, honorable mention, you go and read any Conan comic ever. You know who you are. You know what your tastes in comic books are. If you want a beautifully coloured, detailed, bloody adaptation of Robert E. Howard's work, you go and read Dark Horse. And you accept that after 80 issues of amazingness, it falls off a bit. But it picks up a little. Their King Conan is also pretty solid. If you know that you love that Saturday morning cartoon vibe, you love 70s comics, Bronze Age comics, Marvel has got you covered. And if you just want something that's coming out and it's fresh and you want to be part of the zeitgeist, go and buy Titan.
Read any Conan comic, but not The Sumerian.
I actually quite like The Sumerian, but I'm not going to get into that.
I hate it.
Oh, And before we leave, the Sumerian has reminded me that Conan's in the public domain in Europe, so we don't have to care anymore about rights and IP.
Write your own story. That's how you gotta read more Conan. Make him fight xenomorphs like that one run fanfiction I tried to read in archive.org because I was interested to see what Conan short stories people were writing fanfiction about today, and I don't think any of it is any good.
In the words of Carl Wagner, and I'll insert the quote there.
Alack, alas, no quotes.
Okay, well, I've been your host, Jordy Bailey. I love episodes where I don't have to do any reading or research in advance.
And I've been Duncan Nicol. I am exhausted and cannot wait to get back to our regular... Oh my God, I can't even say things anymore. And I'm Duncan Nicol, and I cannot wait to get back to a regular schedule of reviewing just one book instead of trying to review 70-odd novels that I have read over the past decade. Dear God, it's become a confused mess. I'm sorry. I hope you've enjoyed listening.
So long.
Bye.
Thank you again, fair listeners. We look forward to being back with you again when we discuss The Last Unicorn by Peter S. Beagle and maybe Prior of Your Orange Tree. We'll see. I'll try and finish it. All right. So long.